Good morning, everyone. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Smith, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals, and welcome to wherever you are in this Zoom presentation. Just for the record, I will say what the parties are already aware of course, which is that we are hosting these arguments not live at the Minnesota Judicial Center, but on a Zoom online platform. But we are keeping an audio recording of the proceedings, not a video recording. So you will need to state your name for the record as you commence each leg of your argument so that when we upload the audio, it will be apparent who's attached to each argument. Now, I think that our administrator wasn't able to communicate early on. So I'll just say a couple of things I think she would have mentioned to you, which is that you'll want to make sure that your camera or that your view is in gallery mode rather than speaker mode throughout the proceeding so that you're able to see the clock large enough to know how the time is progressing. And if at any time during the proceeding you have any difficulty hearing or seeing, or you think you're having difficulty being heard, just flag us somehow and we'll pause the proceedings and try to help the technology along and get things caught up. With that, just a reminder that each side will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 for the appellant's counsel and for rebuttal and appellant's counsel. If you're ready to proceed, you certainly may when you're ready.
Thanks, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jared Gorlitz and I represent the appellate Saeed Icy in this matter. This is a case about the basic standards of viewing facts in a motion for summary judgment. In a pro se complaint commenced back in December of 2018, Mr. Icy alleged that he had an agreement with the defendant Amal Financial to loan some money as an investment that was to begin in 2009. Nothing is said about when the payments were supposed to be made on this investment, but he did supplement the allegations in his complaint with a declaration that indicated he did not need the money initially, so he did not make any request for payment, but that in 2014, he started to demand interest-only payments, and then when those weren't made, he demanded the entire amount to be repaid. Again, there's nothing that indicates anywhere that payments were to begin in 2009. Yet on summary judgment before the district court held, and I'll quote from the order, according to the terms of the oral contract, as alleged by Mr. Icy, the agreement required Amal to start making payments no later than 2009. Therefore, Icy could legally demand payments from defendant in 2009. This contradicts the facts in the record. And even if it didn't contradict the facts in the record, the vague allegations in the complaint in the sworn declaration of my client were to be viewed in the light most favorable to him and the least favorable to the defendant. And the court did the opposite of that. It essentially rewrote the allegations in the complaint to determine that payments were to begin in 2009.
Did the court rewrite the allegations or simply interpret the consequences of the allegations as it applies to the point at which your client would have had an accrued cause of action?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it interpreted the vague allegations in the complaint to indicate that payments were to begin in 2009. But again, it kind of echoes my segue into this point, which was that there's nothing in the allegations in the complaint, and I'm sure the court has read it. And I'm sure the court would agree, like most reasonable people would agree, that the allegations are vague as to when payments were to begin, which is why a supplemental affidavit was filed by my client to make it clear when payments were to begin. And the court doesn't rectify, it doesn't even acknowledge the allegations in the complaint are vague. It doesn't rectify Mr. Icy's declaration that indicates that payments were not to begin until 2014 when he demanded them. It simply concludes on its own. I don't know if it's weighing facts. I mean, the court's doesn't explain what it did, but certainly on summary judgment, the court made a factual determination that payments were to begin in 2009. And because of that factual determination, it led to the consequence of the statute of limitations barring my client's claim. If payments so
counsel,
were-
Counsel, sure. If we look at the complaint.
Yes.
Just looking at that, I mean, what this contract is confusing because it doesn't ever, in the complaint, describe when principal payments were due. It just talks about, so that is just unclear to me what this alleged contract is providing, but it says, in paragraph three, investment in exchange for a return of principal plus 2.5% from the receipt of first check. Next paragraph. Plaintiff agreed and paid approximately $57,000 to defendant, and this agreement was signed and was to begin in 2009. When, I mean, as one could read that and say, yes, payments were made before 2010, at least, because it suggests they agreed, paid money, and the agreement was signed and was to begin. Why then, are you saying that no payments were made before 2009? I don't understand exactly why, if the repayment started from receipt of first check, and I assume first checks were in 2009, what's the problem here?
Your Honor, the problem is this is a pro se complaint for somebody who, doesn't, I guess he says investment, when I think most people would agree this wasn't likely an investment. It at best was a loan. And so the complaint's vague. And I think we could all, somewhat interpret what that means. But if you look at the first paragraph, right, there's a proposal to invest in exchange for a return of principal plus 2.5% from the receipt of the first check. To me, that means you can invest money and you're going to get a return on your investment or your loan of 2.5% interest per month. But it doesn't say when the principal is supposed to be returned. It doesn't say when the interest is supposed to be paid. No different than, hey, borrow me $100 and I'll give you, 10% interest on that money. Okay. When am I supposed to start making payments of the interest? When am I supposed to start making payments of the principal? We don't know, right? That statement is vague as to when payments are supposed to be made on this investment or on this loan. It's vague. And so if that's why we prepared the declaration to indicate I invested this money with them and I'm supposed to be getting interest on that investment, right? And so when do payments begin? We don't know. My client clarified that for everyone. He said, I didn't need the money in 2009 or 2010 or 2011. So I told them they didn't need to make me a payment of principal or interest. That means the interest just continued to accrue, like most investments, right? You don't receive your return on the investment until you cash that investment in, whether it's stock or whatever else.
Let's just be clear. I mean, in a business, there are different ways to invest in a company so as to acquire some equity in the company. One is to give money to the company that you don't expect to have returned. The other could be arranged as a loan, which is you need money, I'll give you a loan, but I'm expecting a part of the company and a percentage. And so I don't necessarily agree with you that the arrangement is vague as it's described in the complaint as to what the investment was. And I also have some trouble with your implication that because this is pro se, that the court somehow should have interpreted or should have treated the interpretation process differently from the way the court would have engaged if it had been presented by an attorney. I think our case law is pretty clear that if you choose to engage in litigation pro se, you'll be held to the same standards as if you had been represented by counsel.
And I think that's fair. We're just clarifying the facts as they are, and that this complaint was drafted by somebody pro se. I would have drafted it differently. I would have made it abundantly clear in the allegations of the complaint that, this was a loan investment where you're supposed to get principal and interest returned to you at some point in the future. And it would have said there was no, it would have made it clear there was no statement as to when principal was supposed to be paid. There was no agreement as to when interest was supposed to be paid. And that's why the declaration was drafted. And I think it's drafted pretty clearly that no payments were supposed to be made on that investment and on that loan prior to 2014. Why do you say that though?
Is he says after, if we're looking at what was intended at the time of the agreement in 2009, the declaration says in paragraph four, after making my investment, so after apparently it all started in 2009.
Correct.
I didn't need the money and told them it didn't, told defendant and Amal they didn't need to make payments.
Correct.
You know, that doesn't tell us what the agreement called for. It just says he, you know, it doesn't tell us anything about what the agreement called for. It says what he decided afterwards. And can he extend the statute of limitations indefinitely by just saying, well, I'm saying I don't need it now, even though doesn't tell us anything about the agreement.
Well, doesn't it, Your Honor? I mean, it says, I told them I didn't need the money at the time.
After making the investments, and that is presumably after the agreement. So the agreement calls for X.
Right.
You're saying X is vague. And then he says, after X, I decided, well, yeah, you can hold off, notwithstanding X, or because X is vague, or, I mean, it's kind of a problem. We need to know what X is to know whether the statute of limitations, whether it accrued at the time, irrespective of what he said later, don't we?
Okay, so let's take that, Your Honor, and let's take the facts in the most favorable light to the non-moving party, which is Mr. Icy. Where again does it say that payments were to begin? How can this court say, viewing the lights in the most favorable to Mr. Icy and again against Amal Financial, that payments were to begin in 2009? We don't know. That's the whole point of a disputed fact. That's the whole point of a vague agreement, is for the fact finder to determine those things. This is an unsophisticated person, and I get this is outside the record, but the reality is you can see from the vague allegations in the complaint that these parties didn't know what the investment was or the loan was or when payments were to be made. And what we've done is best clarify the facts that we have, which are he did not demand payment. There's nothing that says he demanded payment in 2009. There's nothing that says that payment was supposed to be made in 2009. And what we have is he that said, I don't need the money right now. I'll take it later. I'll give you $100 and I'll get 10%. Okay. Hey, you know what? I don't need that money now. Why don't you start paying me in a couple of years? Well, you and I didn't have a meeting of the minds on when payments were made on the original agreement. We subsequently determined when those payments were made. And if we're going to view our contract or the contract in this case in the light most favorable to Mr. Icy for the fact finder to determine, we have to go off of what we have. And that is, there is no statement on when payments were to begin. And the law is in Illinois that in such an arrangement, it's clear that payments were to begin upon demand. And that's when the statute of limitations accrue. And here, I get it's vague, but I can't change the facts. I can't change what my client's understanding was. The reality is there is no statement anywhere that says payments were to begin in 2009. And if we're going to view these facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Icy, we have to acknowledge that that is the fact. That is the reality.
Just to be clear then, in paragraph four of the complaint, the agreement was to begin in 2009. So what is it that was to begin in 2009?
Principal was invested to get interest, and interest was to accrue. So I gave you $100 and I'm going to get 10% interest, and it began in 2009. What we don't know is when payments are to be made. We don't know when principal is going to be paid. We don't know when interest is going to be paid. And to me, this is common because I represent people that invest money in real estate and other investments, and those investments aren't your traditional bank loan and those types of things. They say, hey, here's $100,000, invest it for me. And we document that, but it's an open-ended amount of money. I don't know when I'm getting it back. It's essentially back on demand. I know that I'm getting principal. I'm investing principal for a rate of return of interest. And I don't know when I'm getting my money back. Why? Because I'll let that money ride and continue to accrue interest if I don't need it. It's like putting in it a CD or some other, you know, bank investment where you're just accruing interest, right? And then you say, all right, I need that money now. please give me back my principal and interest. And that's the arrangement I see here. And there was no clarification on when payments were to be made. Yet the district court, without any sort of statement whatsoever on when payments were to be made, reached a conclusion that payments were to begin in 2009. And that's weighing the facts, that's interpreting the facts against my client and in favor of Amal Financial, all contrary to the basics of summary judgment, the standards of summary judgment.
Mr. Gorelitz.
Yes.
I understand that the appellant was unrepresented at the time that the complaint was drafted, but he was represented by the time the motion for summary judgment was heard, correct?
Correct, yep.
And the summary judgment motion was heard based on the allegation that there was a signed agreement, right?
He indicated that he affirmed that those were true. He said the agreement was signed. I don't know what he meant by that. We didn't, that to me, that wasn't an issue we were sorting out for the purposes of summary judgment.
Well, the complaint was never amended, right?
Correct. And if the agreement was signed, Your Honor, it would be my position that a check was signed and somebody received it and cashed it, and that would be a contract.
But that was never, the complaint was never amended, and that what you're saying now was never alleged, correct?
No.
And that wasn't actually alleged in his declaration of January 21st either, correct?
What was alleged, Your Honor?
He didn't allege that the signed agreement to which he had made reference in the complaint was in fact the canceled check or some other document that's in the record.
No, he does not. And I think his discovery would indicate there was no actual formal contract or written agreement between the parties other than these checks that were exchanged.
We're running out of time. Can I ask one more question, Judge Ross, of Mr. Gorelitz?
Certainly.
Okay. I want to jump to the unjust enrichment claim and sort of have a similar question with respect to that. That is, the complaint as it's drafted with respect to unjust enrichment does not allege that that's an alternative source of relief, but is instead related to the sale of 22 autos. Again, that was never amended, was it?
Correct, Your Honor, it was never amended.
Do you agree that if you wanted to make that as an alternative basis of relief, you should have amended the complaint to bring that to the district court judge's attention?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor. There is nothing in the rules that clarifies how one brings an alternative claim for relief. And I cited that in my reply brief. Rule 8 is pretty broad. There's nothing in Rule 8 that says my primary arguments, breach of contract, my secondary argument, if breach of contract isn't awarded, is unjust enrichment. The rules of pleading are broad. And so I read that as I don't have to amend the complaint to say that it's an alternative form of relief.
I think I would agree with you if paragraph 19 of the complaint didn't make specific reference to 22 autos.
And I would agree with Your Honor if that count also didn't refer to the other paragraphs in the complaint. And so when that count refers to all the other paragraphs in the complaint and also has this autos or whatever consignment that he's talking about, I would agree with Your Honor that now I'm limited to what's specifically alleged to that count, but that count also incorporated the other allegations.
Yeah, just a moment though. Paragraph 19 says specifically alleges that the defendant has been unjustly enriched by, not by the other things that I've talked about earlier, but by keeping the proceeds from the sale of 22 autos, period.
And I didn't draft the complaint. I understand your Honor's point is I should have brought a motion to amend the complaint. I think if you look at A, the amount in controversy here, and B, the sequence of the procedure, which was I was brought in, I think on the eve of the original trial, it was continued for the purposes of this summary judgment. It would have been an untimely motion to amend. Certainly, I would argue in response to Your Honor's point that nobody objected to our argument that unjust enrichment could not be an alternate claim for relief, including the district court. There's nothing for Mr. Kennedy either in the record or on oral argument that said you know, hey, unjust enrichment. Now, we didn't know this claim. This is untimely. So I would argue that it was actually litigated now by amendment, by essentially consent of all the parties in the court, because the court actually dealt with it as an alternative form of relief. And that's how the court ruled. It said, hey, this could actually be an alternative form of relief, but, end quote, this is the court's language, not mine, to the extent it applies to automobiles and the consignment of a contract, then it doesn't apply. So there's no ruling by the district court, and there was no argument from Mr. Kennedy, and there was no argument from the court that this was somehow an untimely argument. Our primary argument is breach of contract, and we think those facts bear out. And the point and summary judgment was that that was alleged as an alternative form of relief, no objection to it. So I would argue under the rules that was amended essentially by consent to the parties, which isn't uncommon. You know, you get to trial or a motion and something's brought up and everybody proceeds, you know, without some sort of formal amendment.
Thank you. Any further questions by the panel? Thank you, Mr. Grelitt. Your time is expired, but you will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to offer rebuttal argument after the respondent's argument. And with that, respondent's counsel, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm happy to be here with you. My name is Daniel Kennedy, and I represent Amal Financial, Inc. Many of your questions have addressed issues that I would raise, but one that really hits the starting point of my argument is Judge Ross's question, what began in 2009? And Mr. Gorlitz's response was, it was the interest and it was the payments. But Mr. Gorlitz then says that the issue about when the repayment by Amal Financial is not stated. Factually, that doesn't make any sense. The reason that does not make any sense is because the payments by Mr. Issa, or really by Yahya Inc., began in 2008, not 2009. The first check was in 2008. And as has been recited a few times, paragraph 3 of the complaint states that interest begins upon receipt of the first payment. So that began in 2008 as well.
And how do you respond to the argument? I think there, and actually this is something for rebuttal. I think what the appellant is arguing is there's a genuine dispute of fact that should be tried, presumably, although I think asks instead for us just to decide the statute of limitations issue. But there's a genuine dispute of fact about when payments on the interest needed to first be made, as opposed to the interest simply accruing. I think his argument is that he establishes, you know, a genuine dispute of fact about whether the first payment repayment due to him of at least of interest was upon demand. That demand did not occur till later. How do you respond to that?
Thank you, Jeff Smith. There are two responses. One is factual and one is legal. The factual response is that Mr. Issa does allege when the agreement began, and the only thing that could apply to is Amal Financial's responsibility to repay. There's nothing else that could have began in 2009 because the other elements began in 2008.
You're saying that the whole amount was due to him in 2009? What do you mean that? I mean, the agreement began, yes, but when did the agreement call for or payment to him? Is that not the question in terms of when the cause of action accrues? Not yes, when the contract starts, but when the actual breach has accrued?
It had to be in 2009 because there are only three elements. Mr. Issa's payments, when the interest began accruing, and Amal's payments. And two of those were in 2008, clearly. So Amal's right or responsibility, according to Mr. Issa, began in 2009 to start making those payments. The legal reason why it doesn't even matter is because under Illinois law, Mr. Issa's right to demand payment began the statute of limitations. The court, this district court, correctly cited the cases of Mazur versus Stein and Milnes versus Hunt. The Mazur case said that when the creditor may legally demand payment, that's when the statute of limitations begins to run.
Right. And what is the undisputed evidence? or excuse me, where is it undisputed that his right to demand the payment, and I don't know if that's of interest or principle or both, again, but what is the undisputed, how is it undisputed that his right was in 2009 to demand payment? And thus the cause of action accrued.
If it occurred at any time, it began in 2009.
His right to demand payment began in 2009. I suppose
you could argue that it began in 2008 when he made the first payment, and that right away payments were supposed to be forthcoming to him, or at least interest payments. But it certainly didn't happen at some vague time later. And that's really what the Milnes case says. You can't just pick up the baton at some later point and say, oh, now it is starting to run. Now I'm starting to demand payments. Your right begins when you have that right. And I think Mr. Gorelitz will agree that Mr. Issa had the right to demand payment after he made the payment. He may have said, as he alleges, that he decided that he didn't need the money, but he had the right to demand payment in 2008 or 9 at the latest. And so that's when, under Illinois law, the statute of limitations began to run. And so for legal reasons, regardless of what he was, you know, what the facts bear out, he had that right, and the statute of limitations ran 5 years later. He brought the case more than 5 years later. So whether he goes the factual or the legal route, he is foreclosed from bringing this case more than 5 years after he made those payments, because he had the right to get the money then. Mr. Gorelitz.
And is that because the agreement is so vague? I mean, if an agreement from 2009 said, he'll lend money and payments will begin in 2013, for example, if it explicitly said that, the cause of action would not start to accrue until 2013, a failure in 2013, right? I mean, it's not just the date of the agreement, it's when you have a right to collect on it. And is that not right?
That's. I think you're correct. If the agreement had stated that the payments were due, payments by Amal were due at some later point, that would be part of the agreement. And so, you know, same as Mr. Gorelitz pointed out, just your ordinary common example, I lend you $5 and I say, you don't have to pay me for 5 years. I cannot sue you in 4 years for that same money. But that was not part of the agreement. He doesn't allege that was part of the agreement. Mr. Gorelitz pointed out several times that this was a pro se complaint. However, the declaration was made while represented. And certainly at that point, there was every opportunity to clarify the record or to state facts that were missing from the complaint. And what Mr. Issa did was he made the statement, which is on the addendum page 11, after making my investments with Defendant Amal Financial Inc., I did not need the money at the time and told Defendant Amal Financial Inc. it did not need to make payments. First of all, there's no need to make that declaration at all, to state that to Amal Financial if he had the right to get the payment at any time, if it was due on call. If this is a situation where you have something in there saying it's due on call, then changing the call date could have some effect, but he doesn't allege that it was due on call.
Well, more to the point, I mean, by saying that I didn't need the money and implicitly, therefore, I didn't make the request implies that he had the right to do something else, to have made the demand at that time.
That's also true, yep. And importantly, when he says this, it's after making my investments. Now, his last investment was not made in 2008 or 2009. It was made in 2010. That's in the addendum page 15, August 14th, 2010. So in between this time of 2008, going the entirety of 2009 and 8.5 months of 2010, he had that right to demand payment, which he says after he made his last payment at some point afterward, He said, I don't need the money. But he had the right before that point. And that's when the statute of limitations began. And the Milnes case says he can't defer that until he needs the money or makes that demand. So again, for factual and legal reasons, that claim is foreclosed. Mr. Gorlitz did not get to this point, but the court was also correct in noting that the money, except for one check, did not come from Mr. Issa. It came from a corporation. There was no submission showing that Mr. Issa had any stock certificate or any right to make payments on behalf of Issa. He provided no evidence of a distribution, a 1099 DIV to show that this was actually a dividend from the corporation, and that he was not simply just misappropriating some other legal entity's money. But the fact is clear, he didn't spend this money. The corporation lost the money. And this is assuming that they lost the money.
To that point, Mr. Kennedy, he did allege in paragraph 3 of his sworn declaration that the checks in question were from his company. He's the sole owner. He was making investments on behalf of myself personally and not the company. Isn't there at least a fact question there?
I don't think so. First, because he did not provide much in discovery. He did not provide any stock certificates and any actual evidence of proof of ownership of this company.
Did you make a motion to compel or otherwise register dissatisfaction with the discovery that was made?
Yes, there was a motion to compel. I don't remember whether it included this point. I remember most of it was about bank records, which were also not provided. But on this point, you have to show that this is actually your money. You can't just say this is, it belongs to somebody else, but it was made for me. You have to come up with some actual facts showing why it is made for you. This has to be a dividend or something that gives him the right to spend somebody else's money.
Well, that's precisely what he says in paragraph 3, that he's the sole owner and was making investments personally and not on behalf of the company. That's exactly what he says.
Well, he felt that he was making the investments personally, but that's not the question. The question is who lost the money? And he has to show that it was his money. He may have said, oh, I want to sign up for stocks in my name or a loan in my name. We're a little unclear on that. But in the end, it's not his money. Now, if the court were to say he can sue for this money, well, Yaya Inc. can also sue for the money because it did belong to Yaya Inc. So you could have different lawsuits, both claiming for the same money. And as was pointed out also by the judge, only one check actually cleared the bank. That was a $9,900 check. There's no evidence that any of the other checks actually were paid out. And two of them weren't even payable to Amal Financial Inc. They were payable to the authorized seller of Amal Financial Inc. So lots of reasons that Mr. Issa himself doesn't have much of a claim. He's only got the one check that appears to have been from account that was in his name, but no proof that that check actually cleared. Unless that's the one that we do have proof on. I can't remember exactly. I will address unjust enrichment. I think the court was correct in its ruling. I'll note that there is no argument in Mr. Issa's principal brief that the court erred in making its judgment on unjust enrichment. And as the case of McIntyre v. State, that's 458 Northwest 2nd, 714, 1990 Minnesota Court of Appeals decision determines, the issues not raised or argued in appellant's principal brief have been waived and cannot be revived by addressing them in the reply brief. So because that was not argued, that cannot be upheld by the court and it's waived. I agree with the questions, or at least the intent of the questions, regarding unjust enrichment to show that this is not argued in the alternative. It states specifically what its allegation is. It makes no sense in this context. Clearly it was a mistake, but it was a mistake that was not corrected by Mr. Issa or his attorney at any point. And so all we have to go on is the allegations as made.
Can you address the argument that the issue was treated as amended by litigation?
No.
No, you can't address the argument. Or no,
sorry. I thought you said, do you trust the argument? I'm sorry.
No. Would you address the argument?
Okay. Yes. On a motion for summary judgment, we did not address the argument that it was an alternative claim because it was not stated as an alternative claim. So there's no reason for Amal Financial to state, here's why it's not an alternative claim, because it just isn't stated as one. So we addressed it as a claim that was stated as a claim. And the court addressed it as a claim that, I think the court, to be fair, considered the possibility that it was an alternative claim and addressed that issue. But it was not pleaded as such, and it shouldn't be considered as such, I think.
Right, but if the argument, I mean, Mr. Gorelitz is saying, if we check the record, we'll see that it was stated as, or at least an argument that it was an alternative claim. And the district court did, in its decision, make a reference to it potentially as an alternative claim. And if there was no express challenge to it being an alternative claim, but it was argued head on as if it was, I'm trying to get a sense of why Mr. Gorelitz's argument doesn't prevail in the theory that parties who litigate matters as if they are issues, even if they aren't stated so in a complaint, have effectively amended the complaint de facto, and that's the way these issues are treated later on. So there doesn't need to be a formal amendment to the complaint.
Your Honor, I don't have the transcript in front of me. I don't think you'd ever find any spot where I agreed that it was an alternative claim, and I would bet that I argued the opposite, but I don't have that in front of me to argue. I think I'd have to check the transcript on that, but I don't think it can be assumed that it was not stated that it was not an alternative claim, because it's just not simply, it's simply not positioned that way in the complaint. And the focus was, what does this claim mean?
Let's assume for the sake of argument, and I don't know, but let's assume for the sake of argument that if we reviewed the record, we would see that the appellant took the position that it was an alternative theory, alternative claim, that the district court treated it, at least in part, as an alternative claim, and that we don't find any reference in the record challenging that theory by your client. Assuming all those facts, doesn't the amendment by tacit consent apply here, such that there needed to be no formal amendment to the complaint, and the court accepted it as an alternative claim, and that's what we have to treat it as?
I don't think so. I think you can say that, and I'm familiar with the doctrine that you're talking about, through litigation, you can amend your complaint if something is actually litigated. I don't know that that applies in the same way on summary judgment. If somebody just makes a statement, oh, it's an alternative claim, and it's not challenged at that hearing, when it's clearly not stated as an alternative claim, that's it's not the same as a whole new issue that somebody raises. It's just a different positioning of it. I don't know that that would apply in this circumstance, that you can change an alternative claim. I'm sorry, that you can change something to an alternative claim just by stating it at some point on the record and not having somebody else argue otherwise. But as noted by the court, there are other reasons to dismiss the unjust enrichment claim besides this, statute of limitations being the obvious one, but and the fact that it does state exactly what its claim is, and that claim has nothing to do with the facts of this case.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for appellant, rebuttal. We are
no, sorry, I got my mute off.
All right, yeah, very good.
Sorry. Thanks, Your Honor. May it please the court. Again, this is Jared Gorlitz for Mr. Icy, submitting my rebuttal argument. I think Judge Smith kind of articulated our position pretty accurately with respect to that this, our position is that there are disputes of fact with respect to when payments were to begin with respect to this loan investment arrangement between the plaintiff and defendant. And you won't find anything on the record that indicates when payments are to begin.
Well, let me pause you there for a minute. And looking at your client's declaration, paragraphs 4 and 5 in particular, after making my investments, I did not need the money at the time and told defendant it did not need to make payments. In 2014, when I needed the money, I approached and demanded that it start to provide me the payments with interest. Doesn't that statement necessarily imply that your client had the authority to make a demand sooner than 2014? Doesn't it demonstrate clearly that your client had the discretion to do so earlier?
I think these parties had the discretion, Your Honor, to negotiate whatever terms they wanted for their specific arrangement. It could have been that payments begin today, tomorrow, the next day, next week, next month. The issue isn't whether there was discretion on when payments were to begin. The issue was, what was the agreement for the parties as to when payments were to begin?
I'm asking, as to Illinois law, as has been pointed out, and the district court analyzed it, isn't the question, when did your client have a right to demand the payments begin? And if that's so, didn't your client have the right implicit in his declaration to make the demand before 2014?
And my answer to that, Your Honor, is if the agreement between the parties was that payments were to begin right away or could begin right away for interest and principal or just interest, then sure, my client had the discretion. I read that declaration and I drafted it with my client from the standpoint that payments were not to begin right away. So here's the arrangement. You can invest money with me. Okay, here's my $100. I don't need that money now.
Well, there's a difference between payments were not to begin because your client didn't need them, and your client not having the right to make the demand. If for example, your client needed the money in 2009, it seems implicit in this statement that at that point, your client could have approached Amal Financial and demanded to start to provide the interest payments at that time. That seems to be at least what's implied here. Help me point to the language in the declaration that undermines that necessary implication.
Amal Financial, it did not need to make payments. I mean, I guess my, Your Honor, I understand the law in Illinois not to be as narrow as Mr. Kennedy has led this court to believe. And you have to keep in mind that the case he cited, Metsar, is not a loan case. It is a plumber case doing work for somebody. And when the work was done, he had the right to demand payment. So this court needs to go to the loan cases, which is not the Metsar case. And that's the Millinar case that was cited by Metsar. And that says the statute of limitation begins to accrue when a party may begin to demand payment.
Right.
So here, can I finish?
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And we're somewhat agreeing, but my point, Your Honor, is the agreement between the parties was that payment was not going to begin in 2009 because he didn't need the money. So he didn't have a right to demand payment in 2009 because he said, I don't need the money. And so now he has a right to demand payment at some point in the future. And that's when the statute of limitations begins to accrue. It's not because those were the terms of the party. But so, agreed upon between the parties.
So you agree that the, as I understand your statement of Illinois law, is that if you have a contract like you're asserting, which is that payment is only due upon demand,
correct,
that if that demand could be made starting from day one on, that the cause of action accrues starting from day one on, even if no demand is made?
The statute of limitations does not start until demand's made because there isn't a breach until
okay, so that's what I wanted
made.
To clarify. You, and if so you have it
here, the again, the vague contract, I think we somewhat can agree exists, has no indication on when payment is supposed to be made. So payment needs to begin upon demand. It's my position that because there was an agreement that no payment needed to be made, that the law is that the statute of limitations began to accrue when he demanded payment, because that's when the breach occurred. Until
right.
Then,
better said is you think it accrued when there was a failure to pay him upon his demand, that that's when the cause of action accrues in your view.
Thank you. And okay. The secondary point is that the reason this Mutsar case doesn't apply is because a plumber has a right to demand payment when he's done the work. It's not a loan. It's not an investment. It's not a pay me later type situation. I think most people would agree with that. And that's why that case followed made the decision it did regarding when the cause of action accrued. My time's up. If there's any other questions, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I think the court understands our position pretty well.
Well, thank you very much to both counsel for your briefing and your oral argument. And the matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.